Hello, all you jazzy cats and gals out there. I'm gonna talk in my ASMR voice. You have a good one, you do yours.
Good evening, or good morning, wherever you are. Welcome to another episode of Cornbread and Crime.
I have some solid ASMR. Am I saying it right?
You are not.
How do you say there's it? One,
you're adding an extra A in there. It's just ASMR.
ASMR. I have to pause. ASMR. I can't do it. ASMR.
There you go.
Fuck it.
Well, anyway, so welcome back. Thank you for a very successful episode one of Cornbread and Crime, which, let's see, how many views do it have?
Over 200.
Yes. 233 listens.
Ooh, thank you. And we even got emails in, which was pretty exciting as well.
This has been so exciting, y'all. I want to just thank each and every one of you for listening. Mm-hmm. If you're a return listener, welcome back. Or if you're new, welcome to Cornbread and Crime, where we talk about mysteries and crime and such from the state of Georgia. Oh, and cornbread recipes. Can't forget that.
Hence the name, exactly.
Hence the name. Okay, so first I want to start off by talking about a recent piece of news in the true crime community, and that is the new implementation of a opt-in system with GED Match. Are you familiar with GED Match, Sarah?
I am not, Adam. Please go on.
Well, GED Match essentially is, it's like a DNA ancestry service in the same vein as 23andMe or Ancestry, except that for whatever reason, law enforcement is able to upload profiles of DNA into the system and do comparisons and matches. It's a little bit easier. The system works out better that way than it would if law enforcement tried to do it with Ancestry or 23andMe.
Are there less protections?
I think so. I think it's just the way that the policies and the way that company is set up has allowed kind of this perfect storm of comparison.
Is this the service that they use to catch, like, Golden State? And
yes, Golden State was actually the one that the Golden State Killer out in California was the one that kind of brought this to the forefront, in my opinion, and I think many others, that it really, and then afterwards it was just a landslide, like, cold cases were getting solved left and right because of this, because everybody realized you could submit this and using familial genetic forensic genealogy, I guess is what they call it. And they were just able to, track down people's families. You know, they put some DNA in, and they're able to find someone's second cousin twice removed, and they were down from there. And it's been huge recently within the true crime and cold case community for sure. And so recently, though, and I also figured this would happen. I figured it would only be a amount of time before either a law came out or a policy change would happen. And just recently, they switched to where now you now have to opt in for law enforcement to be able to compare your genetic information to their submitted samples.
With this specific company or all companies?
I believe this is just GED Match.
Okay.
But apparently, like, no update email was sent out to people who are already in the system. There apparently was not a message otherwise. And I've only heard this from people who are part of GED Match, who do have their profiles in there. They said that they had received no communication about this. So going forward, if you join or that and you want to participate in this kind of thing, you have to opt in. And then, this whole thing's kind of been an interesting controversy where, you know, some people, you know, there's privacy concerns. And I can understand that. And I can understand skepticism when it comes to this whole system. So
absolutely.
But yeah, that's one thing that's being debated right now, is, you know, like, bringing awareness to this, you know, is it right, is it wrong, somewhere in between.
What do you think?
Oh gosh, I mean, it's complicated. I mean, I can't deny the results. And the results that we have are, those have their names back, murderers who might have just faded into history are now have been caught.
Mm-hmm.
Rapists have been identified decades down the line. So I can't deny the results, but I definitely sympathize with kind of the line of questioning of, how far does it go? Where does it stop? Where are the implications of this? And so I definitely sympathize with that. But then again, you have to think about it too. Like, if law enforcement really wanted to get your DNA or fingerprints, if they were determined, it would not be that difficult because we throw away our trash, we touch things out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, yeah, like we leave ourselves everywhere. That makes sense.
That's one thing I've always noticed on, like, I'm sorry, one thing I've always noticed on TV shows, they're like following this guy around in a restaurant, and then he spots like the officers in the restaurant, and he dumps his cup and like water, like, oh, can't get my fingerprints now or DNA now. Do cops actually do that?
I mean, that's what happened in Golden State when they wanted like an actual, like, his DNA profile to compare. They like followed him around and they got him on like guy's DNA off like a cup he threw away.
Oh, because it's technically you're no longer holding it.
I guess it's not your property. It's your trash. It's free game, I suppose.
It's garbage. So, yeah. What if it's like? So I guess if it's on your property, then they would need like a warrant.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, versus like a public.
I'm no expert in the law, but that sounds.
I'm gonna go with true.
That sounds correct. I mean, yeah, that's.
I watched La Law. Oh, you don't watch Golden Girls. You don't get my
Nope.
Listeners will get my reference. Don't do that to me. This is gold here. They will love that shit. Mm. If you just watched the Golden Girls, you would know. I would just like to say that it was really amazing going back to what we were talking about in the beginning of all the support and the emails we received. And my favorite part was we actually had a few people who became self-proclaimed couch constables. It's a pretty great feeling. So thank you for that.
Yes, the name has stuck, and despite my initial reaction to it, it's growing on me, so I think it's here to stay.
I feel like we're news anchors because we're just sitting side by side, and we're like, and back to you, Adam. Or I'm like Weather Girl over here. Mm-hmm. No, you'll be Weather Girl. I'm the anchorman. Yeah. We're just like, and back to you.
But definitely, welcome back, Couch Constables.
I would say we would have a battle cry, but the name itself implies that, meh.
Maybe it'll happen. Maybe it'll come along. We'll see.
Oh, cool. The Fall Line, our podcast crush, gave us a shout out too, which was pretty great.
But I always love hearing from them, and definitely go check out their series on the Mill and Jane Doe, who Sarah covered last week.
Oh, yeah.
It was so good. Anyway, so who do you want to go first? Or do you want me to go first?
I vote we do the Does first.
Okay.
And then we can get to the mystery.
Fine by me. The John Doe I'll be covering today. In the Doe Network, he is listed as 1029 UMGA. It was December 19th, 1980, when the skeletal remains of a Caucasian male were found at the base of a large tree near a construction site on Northside Parkway near Interstate 75. Another source I found says that the man was found in a brush cubby hole, which I interpret to kind of just maybe be like a, kind of like a, maybe it's like a little, not a catacomb, but like kind of like a, it's like a little like under the highway hideaway spot.
Mm-hmm.
Where maybe like the Department of Transportation might store brush or like tools or maybe park some vehicles, kind of that kind of area.
You see, my immediate reaction was like a rabbit burrow. Like, you know how they live in the holes. Anyway.
Most of the bones were recovered, but the jawbone was missing, as well as the left foot. A lower denture was found nearby, and the upper jaw had no teeth. The man was estimated to be between 5'10 and 6 feet, and around 175 pounds. He was estimated to be between 50 and 70 years old, but probably closer to 60. His hair was a mix of blonde and gray, and was considered fairly long. Moderate in length, although I will say that it's potential that maybe while he was living it wasn't that long, and during the period, or I mean, hair is weird because you never know how it might grow at any point, or people can cut it. It's very easy to you can't really go off,
mm-hmm.
oh, he had long hair, you know, because we don't know that he had that in life or not.
Because in decomposition, it's not that your hair grows, it's that your skin kind of shrinks a bit, right? And it appears longer.
I've heard same both, and nails. I have no idea. But oh.
That's what my 11th grade forensics class told me. I defend you, coach.
His hair was a mix of blonde and gray. It was estimated that he had been deceased at the location for many months, at least.
Mm-hmm.
There were no indications of foul play.
I'm sorry, where is this again?
It's in Atlanta. It's in the northeast part of Atlanta. It's described as, it's kind of weird that it's not like a super precise position. It's kind of described as where Northside Parkway and Interstate 75, kind of like between the two roads, like where they kind of meet,
mm-hmm.
or where they kind of, but there's like a good, like, I think mile and a half maybe where the two of those roads are parallel, essentially.
Yeah.
So it could be anywhere in between that. In between, I've got the map pulled up right here.
Ooh, fancy.
Essentially, it's going to be anywhere along I-75 and Northside Parkway, north of West Paces Ferry Road and south of Mount Perron Road. And if you look at the map here with me right now, that's mm-hmm. like northwest Atlanta. It's near Buckhead.
Okay.
It's very near Paces and West Paces, which is today is very affluent. It is a very rich part of town.
Oh, yeah.
Don't know what it was like in the 80s or the late 70s. If you're listening and you know what the area was like back then, we would love to hear from you.
Mm-hmm.
So shoot us an email. Tell us what the area was like back then, because we don't know. The deceased was wearing a blue shirt with a 16.5-inch collar size and a sleeve length of 34 to 35 inches. A brown belt was also found with the remains. So this John Doe's personal effects are quite notable, and what I'm about to talk about was found in a billfold that was found with the remains. The one that sticks out to me the most is a photograph of a young girl. Written on the back of this photograph is September blank, comma, 4 years old. And it's because of this that they estimate this, of course, that this child was 4 years old in the photograph.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I think she looks a little bit older than four, but I mean, if the writing's true, then she's four. She's wearing what looks like a yellow turtleneck and some sort of overalls. She has brown eyes and reddish brown hair. And assuming the photo was taken sometime around 1980 and that the child was around 4 years old then, the girl today would be in her mid-40s. And I'm no expert in period clothing, but I would hazard a guess that this clothing looks like it would fit in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
all the way up to 1980. The background of this photograph looks like a school photo background, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
A church directory or professional family portrait business also comes to mind as potential sources for this photo. We'll post photos of this and some other objects on our social media, which I will talk about later as well. So here's the photo of the little girl that was mm-hmm. found with the John Doe here.
Yeah. I can see why you say she isn't four, because she looks older. Definitely looks older. I would say
4 to 7, 4 to 8.
Yeah, I was going to say 5 to 7.
5 to 7. And I mean, she still very well could be four
mm-hmm.
as well.
I was pretty tall as a four-year-old. So.
Yeah, and the photo is pretty degraded. They've touched it up some. So, you know, there's an amount of detail here that maybe isn't in the original photo.
It definitely does look like a school picture or, like, as you said, a nice family portrait kind of.
Yeah, something like that.
Sit down, little Susie, and we'll take your picture kind of thing.
Yeah. And when I was doing research for this case, I got the Freedom of Information Act request.
Ooh.
And I got the medical report. And I was looking through it to see if I could maybe try to set up an interview with the original medical examiner in this case. But unfortunately, that doctor has passed away back in October of 2016. But the only reason I'm mentioning this is that the doctor. His name is Dr. I might be pronouncing this wrong, so I apologize ahead of time. Dr. Saleh A. Zaki.
I would say Saleh.
Saleh. Dr. Saleh A. Zaki. He was a medical student in Egypt and in the 50s and 60s, and he spoke out against the government after the 1967 Six-Day War with Israel. And after that, he became a little more fearful for the safety of him and his family.
Mm-hmm.
And so they fled Egypt, eventually landing in the United States, ending up in Atlanta, and apparently making an impact here on the local medical examiner scene. He had a very long career here, and I honestly, we can probably make a podcast just on this man's life. It's incredible. Yeah.
It's amazing.
The second item is an unspecified faded photograph with writing on the back. The writing potentially says HR Bow Dyeing and Finishing, .278-3448. The photo apparently was so damaged that they couldn't make out what the photo was of.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just the authorities' interpretation of what the writing on the back says. It's pretty unclear, but this is just one interpretation. So I just want the listeners to bear that in mind. From what I researched online, there's been a moderate amount of research into HR bow dyeing and finishing. The biggest guess is that it has something to do with the textile industry.
Yeah.
But apparently they have not found an HR bow company. And the phone number, well, I would guess is a phone number. I mean, I feel like this is somewhat, maybe even fairly obviously a phone number. I mean, it's 3 digits with a dash in the middle followed by 4 digits. So it looks like a phone number that's missing an area code. What do you think?
Were phone numbers like that in the 80s? I don't know. Like, because, you know, way back when it was like, operator, get me Murray Hill 905.
Well, I mean, in that case, I could be very wrong.
I wonder if it could be like an item number.
Potentially.
Like dyeing and finishing makes me think of wool. As you said, textiles. Maybe it was like this cotton brief. I don't know.
I mean, there's plenty of textile businesses in the South. I mean, I know Dalton, the city of Dalton is pretty big. I think there's a few places in South Carolina that I know of that are big with it. I mean, there's a lot of textile business here. The third effect includes fragments of a handwritten letter that reads as follows. 4-3-blank. And I'll be saying blank when the lettering is obfuscated. So that's 4-3-blank. Dear Dad, hope yo all right here. Hope blank it help. TH of us. As usual, period. Nothing new, blank much. Both had blank illins. Ha ha, really, blankly. You let me know plenty of this, a cat plus blank. Ha ha. Take can get together, blank together. Wonderful husband. Blanking after me. Call or writing. Fine, he's great dog and behave. No right. Love, Pam, Dwight. Now, that probably didn't make a lot of sense because it is very fragmented. And there were also, you know, I said blank when there was stuff missing, but I do believe that there are other letters. I'm in fact fairly certain that there are other letters and words missing other than just the times that I said blank. I'll post an image of the fragments here so that's a little bit easier to read for the people listening. One point of contention that gets debated a lot in this case, apparently, is that with Pam and Dwight, they're not sure...
I'm sorry, Pam and Dwight or Pam Dwight?
Well, that's the issue of contention, is that they're not sure if it's a plus sign, as in Pam and Dwight, or if it's a T with Pam T. Dwight.
Oh, okay.
So they're unsure if this is two people being referenced or just one. If I had to take a guess, I would say it's probably Pam and Dwight because I don't know many people who would sign their name on a personal letter with a middle initial.
Yeah, if it was your dad too, I wouldn't write
your
you wouldn't my be full so name. Form- yeah, it would just be so Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're maybe if you're estranged. If you're estranged, you're probably not writing your dad letters.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's also exceptions to the rule and all that. But yeah, I would find it very strange for someone to write a middle initial when signing a personal letter like this to a family member.
Mm-hmm.
So if I had to hazard a guess, I would say it's Pam and Dwight. So there's the image of the fragment that says "Love Pam something Dwight."
How do they know that says Dwight?
Yeah. So the people who are listening, it very clearly says "Love Pam" and then some sort of symbol, which could be a T, could be a plus sign, could be another symbol, and there looks to be a DW. What I'm guessing is that there probably is another fragment that has the rest of the word Dwight on it.
Or Dwayne.
I mean, yeah, it also could be that they're just guessing Dwight and mm-hmm. that they're just going off DW names. But I'm not sure. But I would hazard a guess that either they've guessed at the name or they have another fragment that's not in this picture.
It looks like not the curly Q and symbol on your keyboard, but just the little meep mop moop. You know what I'm saying?
No, I do not know what a an meep upside mop noop is.
You missed my movements. It, like the upside down four, that and symbol.
It also looks like a lowercase y almost, too. I'll let you guys look at it on social media and decide for yourselves. So there's a lot of people that say that Pam is more than likely the daughter of this John Doe, with Dwight being the husband. Another possibility is that Pam and Dwight could be both his children, and it's brother and sister writing this letter. Or it could be that Dwight is the son of the John Doe and Pam is the non-related wife, technically. And there's also, I would say, probably a pretty good chance that the young girl in the first photo is his granddaughter.
Hmm.
The last personal effect is a faded bus ticket, most likely from Panama City, Florida. Other writing on the ticket is too faded to discern. Panama City in 1980 had a population of around 33,000. And the city is on the Florida Panhandle and is known for the nearby vacation destination of Panama City Beach. A bus probably would have taken the man through Dothan, Alabama, and Columbus, Georgia, on its way to Atlanta. Florida is a popular destination for travelers and people with a transient lifestyle. There's no way to tell if this man was actually from Florida or if he just happened to be there before he came to Atlanta. Perhaps he was just trying to get home somewhere else in the United States and just happened to pass away while passing through Atlanta. But that is all we have on this John Doe. And it stuck out to me mainly just because you have personal photos and writing, and there just seems to be, you know, I feel like there's evidence here that's more than you typically get with a lot of these Jane and John Does. So you have personal effects and personal information. And that is the story of 1029 UMGA.
Nice. Good job. Alrighty, are you ready?
Let's hear it.
Okay. So tonight I would like to talk about the murders of Russell and Shirley Dermond, also known as the Lake Oconee murders. Now, this has actually been pretty popular lately. I think it's been covered in... There was one you told me about, a podcast.
I don't remember which podcast, but I think there is one that either did cover it or they're about to cover it.
Yeah, you're like, oh, look, the subject you're about to talk about. Once again, I have been usurped. It's fine. Found what I was trying to say. My sources tonight are from the Macon Telegraph, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, 11 Alive, and they have a good section called Gone Cold. Or gone cold, something like that. But one of the Macon Telegraph contributors, his name is, I kid you not, Jason Voorhees.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Right? Like, I think there's an O missing from the movie, Jason Voorhees, but that's how you would say it, right?
I wonder if that's a pen name.
Pen name. Well, people would always remember it.
Yeah.
That made my day. I'm not going to lie. So, fun fact, when you Google Lake Oconee murders, you get two separate cases. One of them is Russell and Shirley Dermond. The other one, I completely forgot the name, but I just kind of briefly read it because it's very similar. It was like killer caught and billionaire murder, or millionaire murder, sorry. And I was like, okay, sure, I didn't know they were millionaires. And it was like, Earl didn't mean to hit Jesse in the head with a popcorn maker, but he did. And I was like, I don't think that's the correct one. So if you guys do look up Lake Oconee murders, just Google Russell and Shirley Dermott. So let's talk about the Dermotts a little bit. On December 15th, 1950, Shirley Wilcox and Russell Dermott got married. And they were actually married for 62 years.
That is a long marriage. That's a good marriage right there.
Definitely. They had 4 children and 9 grandchildren. They were both really involved in their local community and church. A little bit about Russell. He was actually a World War II veteran. He served in the Navy. He was a retired clock manufacturing executive.
Clock manufacturing executive.
Like, name a clock that is mass produced.
Rolex.
There you go. Maybe you work for Rolex.
I mean, yeah, people make clocks. So I mean, maybe just
people have clocks, yeah.
People have clocks. There we go. There's a new catchphrase for everybody. People have clocks.
That should be the name of our episode, People Have Clocks.
There we go. Episode name right here. You heard here first, folks.
People have clocks. Yeah, and it was in the 80s, so. Ooh. How awesome would it be if he was like one of the guys that helped make the calculator watches?
I mean, who knows? Who knows what he did?
That would be amazing. But that was in New York in the 80s. And then in the 90s, he owned a few Hardee's or Carl's Jr. for our other listeners not in the South. And he had them until 1994 till he retired. He loved golf, reading, walking, enjoyed spending time with his family and friends. So Shirley Wilcox Dermott, there's not a lot of information about her as much as Russell, but she loved crossword puzzles, was an avid writer and artist, and she was a pretty well-known bridge player as well.
Hmm.
I've never played bridge.
Me either.
Or canasta. Those are like classic card games that I've always wanted to learn.
Never been much of a card player.
Oh, that's right. You hate cards, and it kind of hurts me.
I hate cards. It's not my...
You don't like...
It's not my passion.
What's the game that you hate that they played in college?
What was it called?
Nerds.
Nerds. I do hate nerds. Just because everybody was all about it while I was in college, and it just there's just too much.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like every freaking day, someone was trying to play nerds. Enough of the nerds was my motto back then. Enough of the nerds. Not even the E in enough, just enough. Enough of the nerds.
Enough of the nerds.
Enough of the nerds.
Enough of the nerds. There's a... Cracker Barrel sells this game. It's basically nerds, but I can't think of the name, but it's super fun, and it hurts me that you don't love it. But anyway, she loved bridge.
Sorry, not sorry.
Well, they lived for 15 years inside the Reynolds Great Waters Gated Community, which is a nice... community, and it has like a golf course on the inside. It's gated, it has a security guard there, and it's in Putnam County, which is near Lake Oconee. In fact, their house is just off of Lake Oconee, and their house was pretty secluded as well. So all in all, they were a very well respected and beloved couple with no known enemies. Let's talk about the timeline before the murder. Oh, gave it away. Well, I said it earlier.
They already know, yeah. So lay it on me.
Okay. Thursday, May 1st, 2014. Russell was running some errands around town, and that was the last day he was seen alive. So that Thursday. At 2:15, he went to the bank. He used the drive-thru to transfer some money. At 2:16, security cameras show him at the nearby Publix. He's picking up a prescription for Shirley because she had an upcoming cataract surgery. He also picked up a loaf of bread and a few cucumbers.
Okay.
Cucumber sandwiches, maybe? Remind me about that. And then, nothing. The couple was supposed to attend a Kentucky Derby party on that Sunday, May 4th at 4 p.m., but they never showed.
Okay, so when was the last time he was seen again?
2:16, That Thursday.
Thursday. So I suppose it's safe to say that sometime between that time on Thursday and when the party started on Sunday, that is when the murders occurred.
On the nose. You are correct. And my thought about the cucumbers and the bread, and I was like, maybe they're making cucumber sandwiches for the party. On the 6th, after growing concerned, a neighbor checked in on the Dermans and then called the police. The police arrived, searched the house, and inside the garage, they discovered Russell's decapitated body slumped between the couple's cars. And Shirley was nowhere to be found. I remember hearing about this case on TV, and I think this is when it hit the national level, too. Like,
yeah, I remember when this happened, for sure. I think I had just graduated college the year before, and I was visiting, I want to say I was visiting friends in Milledgeville, I want to say the week or the week after, or the week after that, and I remember we were talking about it, because it was still fresh in everybody's minds, and the news was still on it, and so I definitely remember it happening.
Oh, yeah. People everywhere were talking about it. When it hit the local, state, and national level, people were searching the area for Shirley. There were missing signs posted all over town. I remember it was shared on Facebook a couple times, like, help find her. Some people thought she might have been kidnapped. But no one had seen or heard from Shirley until 10 days later when her body was discovered by local fishermen about 5 miles from her home.
In Lake Oconee?
Yeah.
Okay.
The autopsy revealed that she died of blunt force trauma, about 2 to 3 blows to the back of her head. Her body had been tied down with 30-pound cinder blocks and thrown into the lake. Let's talk about the sheriff, Howard Sills.
Okay.
Okay. I believe you know about him, too. He is the sheriff of Putnam County, and he is known to be incredibly candid. His first famed claim was cracking down on a local cult called the Nuwabian Nation of Moors, led by Dwight York. It originally started in New York, and then it just kind of changed over the years, adding different ideologies, until, not really sure why, he moved down to Georgia, and he made this giant compound that looked like an Egyptian complex called Tama Re.
I think I remember reading about this at some point.
Yeah, like they built actual pyramids.
Like a pyramid, yeah.
Yeah, and there were sphinx heads everywhere, and it was different for Georgia, definitely. But as it turns out, surprise, surprise, with cult leaders, Dwight York was pretty much a piece of shit pedophile. He was indicted on 197 counts of child molestation.
That's a lot.
That is an insane amount. He was convicted to 135-year sentence for transporting minors across state lines in the course of sexually molesting them, also racketeering and financial reporting charges. So this guy is a really, really terrible person who hurt a lot of people. Going back to the sheriff of Putnam County, Howard Sills, I keep wanting to call him Hills, Sills. He was the guy who originally went up against the cult leader and helped bring him to justice. So that's his claim to fame. That's what everyone knew him by until these murders. He often says that the murders are like a yoke around his neck, because that's what everyone now knows him by.
Is that a quote? That
that's a said? Quote.
Okay.
This case became, as we said, a national whodunit, and a lot of people are asking, well, why would someone do something this terrible to a nice couple like the Dermans? And this is a quote. He said, damn the why. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to curse a second here. Though I've been doing it all night long, so I should apologize. Don't listen, Mom. He said, damn the why. Get the evidence. Make the case. The why can be a significant, if not the most significant factor in determining the who. So you don't ignore it. But let's not dwell on the esoteric. Let's dwell on putting this bastard on the chain gang. Or better, put his ass in the electric chair. But he goes on.
Okay.
If God and the law would give me the opportunity, I'm going to send the son of a bitch to hell in my hand. I've gotten up every day of my life and asked God Almighty to give me the opportunity to hurl a hoodlum into hell. This son of a bitch or sons of bitches or bitches.
He's kept rolling with the bitches on that
one. He is. That reminds me of one of my favorite cards against humanity cards. Bitches. So good. Better one? Bees? This son of a bitch, or sons of bitches, or bitches, need it. And they need it in the worst sort of way. And I hope the hell I deliver. And I hope... I guess it meant to hell. This is the hell. And I hope to hell that I can deliver it. Nothing would please me more. Sheriff Sills is all but certain that the culprit is not a local and that there had to be two people.
He's been with Putnam County for a long time.
Very long time. Yeah, he's their lead investigator as well. Okay. Like, he's been there, I think it said 25 years. I could be wrong, but as you said, really long time. So Sills has sought help from law enforcement agencies around the world and at the federal level from the FBI, but he refuses to ask help from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. He's never asked the GBI to assist in any of his investigations, quoting, "If I need him, I'll call him," which is interesting because the GBI in most Georgia counties is the lead investigator in murder cases. They have more resources, they have better funding. It's just better all around, really. The reason he said he does not work with the GBI, quote, "I have been involved in investigations where they have literally told people to destroy evidence." The GBI is actually the ones who processed the physical evidence from the Derman murders. So why would you let a law enforcement agency that you said you don't trust because they destroy evidence process the physical evidence in your most prolific murder case?
Yeah, it's a good question.
And the reason why the GBI hasn't stepped in is because they can only come in if local law enforcement ask for help. Is that correct?
Yes.
Like, they can't take a case like the federal.
No, they have to come in if they're invited or I think if it's state property.
Okay. Let's talk about some theories. I know you're familiar with this case, correct?
I've read through it a few times, yes.
Okay. So come with me down the rabbit hole of red herrings.
Let's go.
Why the decapitation?
I know there's two theories that I've seen. One of which is that... is that it was done as proof of the deed,
mm-hmm.
for whatever purposes to that end.
Yeah.
Or also that potentially that if a firearm was used, that this was done to potentially remove that evidence.
Because it could be traced?
Potentially, yes. Okay. Especially if the gun is registered to someone.
Definitely. I've heard that theory. I didn't hear the, here's the head for proof of the kill, kind of.
And I think that one is... least likely.
That's something out of a movie.
Yeah, this is something that was just mentioned. I wouldn't say it's one that necessarily I subscribe to.
Another theory is that when the case first came out, that this was done by professionals. What do you think?
I think that kind of ties into why some people think it might be like a decapitation for the sake of proof, because maybe that is the way for the professional to prove that the job was done, perhaps.
Yeah. But I don't know if a professional would, like, stick around for that long. You think they would just be, like, in and out and maybe not use a weapon that can be traced back.
Yeah.
Another theory is robbery. However, at the time the house was combed over, none of the jewelry was taken. All the medications were there. Everything seemed as it was. Nothing was taken.
That's very atypical of a robbery.
Yeah.
That definitely points away from the robbery theory if a whole lot of valuables were left behind like that.
Definitely. Definitely. And Shirley's phone and purse were also inside the house as well. So some people, and these theories I got from Reddit, y'all, you can check there too. And from the different articles I read, some people also believe that maybe the killers came upon the house. Because it's a pretty nice house. It's right on the lake. And they came upon the house and thought there might be maybe some more money. Or things of more value in there than there were. The other theory is revenge. The Dermans had four children. Three sons, one daughter. Their eldest son, Mark, was actually murdered in Atlanta in 2000 near the now no longer there Georgia Dome, basically in downtown Atlanta. He was shot during a drug buy, and his killer is in prison but has no known ties to Russ and Shirley. And at the time, the couple wasn't even really close to their son when he passed. So what do you think of this theory? Do you think maybe it has something to do with Mark's? Because two murders within one family? Completely different?
I don't think it's related, personally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a long time difference. And, I mean, I don't see why Russell and Shirley would be connected to this.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, I think there's enough distance in the facts, almost, just to be, like, I mean, I don't think there's anything to avenge here. Like, I don't see a motive in there for that.
Definitely. All right, so those are some popular theories on Reddit and various news outlets. What is your theory, Adam? Do you have a theory?
Gosh, I really don't. It's definitely strange, which is why it's so covered in the news, because this is just so brutal and unusual for the area. And I mean, it looks like someone had some sort of beef with them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a lot of violence. But I mean, it doesn't appear to be, at least from what's been released to the public, that there's, you know, they say that, you know, they didn't have any enemies.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? I don't know if anything else is, if, you know, law enforcement knows more than we know, or if there's secrets around. I don't know. But I don't know. This seems like such a violent act, but there is no why. Like, we don't have that. Like, we don't have, like, the motive is just elusive in this.
I honestly don't have a theory either out of the ones we talked about. The one I lean more towards is that someone thought maybe they had more money than they did.
Mm.
Like, it was a group. Do you think it was one killer or two or multiple?
I can see cases being made for one or two.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least one.
I mean, yeah, of course. I think it's an elderly couple. Yeah, if it was, especially, you know, a young man with a weapon.
Or a woman.
A younger person with a weapon. I could see them being able to take control of that situation. But equally, I could also see two people doing it. But the only thing that makes me think it's not two people is that it's insanely hard to keep secrets in groups. And even in a group of two,
mm-hmm.
I would just be very surprised that more information hasn't come out sooner if it was more than one person involved. But yeah. I could be wrong on that. Who knows?
I agree. I think also maybe the killer did have beef with the Dermans, as you mentioned. Because aren't stranger, like, murders incredibly rare? Like, it's usually someone the victim or victims know.
I believe the stats is that most murders are going to be committed by someone that you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's someone that's close to you or is just an acquaintance.
Yeah.
There's typically, if you're going to be murdered by someone, I believe that there's going to be some sort of trail, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a family member or a lover or a friend or maybe, like, someone that you're transactional with. Like, maybe someone you know, So someone that you that's connected to you somehow, even if it's a small connection. But true stranger murders, I do believe, are more rare, but they still do happen, though.
So this case is still active. And, of course, if you have any information, please report that to the Putnam County Sheriff Office. I'm sure Sheriff Sills will be more than happy to
listen to you. Yes, please do not contact us. Contact authorities.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's my murder. What do you got?
Okay, County Constables, we do have a social media presence now. You can find us as Cornbread and Crime on Facebook, at Cornbread and Crime on Instagram, and at Cornbread Crime, that's at Cornbread Crime with no and on that, on Twitter.
Wait, someone has the username Cornbread and Crime?
I think there might have been a character limit or something. I think for some reason I was not able to put the and in there somehow.
Oh.
And maybe I could work on that. We'll see. I'm excited for the future here. We'll be having a new logo and an opening jingle coming hopefully soon. We have some good content planned for the future, including a Jane Doe case, which I believe we'll be able to do a pretty good little deep dive into some of the details in there. So I'm very much looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully going forward, we will also have a guest for each episode. I'm very sad that we don't have one this time, but hopefully from here on out, we will have guests. Don't forget, you can email us at cornbreadandcrime@gmail.com with any content, insight, comments, feedback, suggestions, or if you're interested in being a guest, let us know. Don't be shy.
May I add? Also, send in your cornbread recipes or any fun stories you just want to share.
Yeah, why not?
We'll totally read your stuff.
My cornbread recipe for today
is the
Fox Brothers Barbecue Jalapeno Cornbread.
Oh my gosh.
The beloved local institution of Fox Brothers.
It's an amazing barbecue place in Atlanta for those viewers. The 2% of our viewers who are in Australia and in England. It's a great barbecue place.
If you are ever in Atlanta, I definitely recommend making a stop by Fox Brothers. So, this recipe.
Can we make it?
Sure.
We'll eat it on our next episode.
This recipe was printed in the AJC. The total time is 40 minutes, and it serves 10. You need 3 cups of self-rising cornmeal, not cornmeal mix, 1 1/4 cups of all-purpose flour, 1/4 cup of sugar, 1 8-ounce package of cream cheese, cold, cut into 1/4-inch cubes, 2 cups of buttermilk, 1 cup of creamed corn, 3 eggs, 1/4 cup of vegetable oil or melted unsalted butter, 1/4 of a cup of orange juice, and 3 jalapenos, finely minced.
Nice. Orange juice is new for me. I've never seen that in a cornbread
recipe. I have not seen that either.
This is exciting.
It is different. Preheat your oven to 350 degrees. And in a large mixing bowl, combine the cornmeal, flour, and sugar. Add the cream cheese and toss to distribute evenly. In a 1-quart measuring cup, combine the buttermilk, creamed corn, eggs, oil or butter, orange juice, and jalapenos. Pour wet mixture into dry mixture and stir until just combined. Pour into greased 9x13-inch baking pan. Bake 25 to 30 minutes or until lightly browned.
That sounds amazing.
Oh, yeah. I want to do it now.
Yeah, let's definitely do it.
Yeah, right now.
Yeah. Bye. So what is something great that happened to you recently? I could go. Did I put you on the spot?
Yeah, I got it.
Oh, you got it?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, now that summer is here, I am starting to partake in one of my favorite summer activities, which is swimming. Love swimming. So
you do.
Spend some
definitely.
Time at the pool. Yep.
So something great that happened to me was, I don't think I've told you this. Where I work, I'm on the middle floor. So I take the elevator down, and oftentimes people, they'll be on their phones. The elevator stops. They walk out a second and be like, oh, I'm on the wrong floor. I meant to go down to the lobby. Let me get back.
Very common occurrence.
Yeah. So I was heading out. And that same occurrence happened with a lady, and she walked back in. She was looking down at her phone. She's like, man, these damn phones are distracting us. And I was like, yep. She's like, we got to do better. And I was like, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I'm ready to go home. Yeah, I agree with you, sure. She seemed really nice. But as she stepped out, she turned around and looked at me and went, did exactly this. Okay. And then turned around and walked away.
Okay.
And I was like, I like that woman. She just did not give a flying flip what anyone thought. And it just made my day. So it's just something random. So send us in your fun random interactions that make you happy, and we'll read it.
Tell us something good.
Exactly. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. Oh, we should have said this in the beginning. My name's Sarah.
And I'm Adam.
And thanks for listening to Cornbread and Crime.
See you later, couch constables.